G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 7 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. Now, if you're joining us for the first time, then this will be the only time that I tell you to stop, leave this podcast, and go back one episode, as this is part 2 of Kevin Bowe's career, so it's best to start there on part number 1. For everyone else, let's get straight back into it.
You know, we were cycling the engines at something like 18 or 20 minutes, which means that, you know, if you go any worse than about a cycle an hour, your overhaul costs are trebling.
Yeah, I remember when we flew the caravans, myself in the Whitsundays there, sometimes we were doing 4 cycles an hour.
Yeah, anyway, we thought, oh, maybe these other runs will come off of the turbine. So we actually did a trial run with the Bureau of Meteorology out to these outer weather stations, which was just fantastic. And I remember one of them in particular, Willis Island, which has a very crescent-shaped lagoon, actually. It's not fully enclosed by any means. And the weather station is on the northwestern side of the Kay, and the Kay is a sort of moon-shaped back around through the east and to the south. So the southeast winds comes across the sand without any real problem. You don't get much turbulence. But the actual run in the lagoon is not all that long. So it's not really a full lagoon. It's just a sheltered water. So what I did coming in there is what the guy in Canada had taught me to do, is as you come in to the calmer water, you're holding it just above the water, about 12 inches off the water. And as you come in over the shallow bay or this calmer water, you just crank it through into reverse while you're still in the air. And it just goes and sits down like a pelican on the water. You're lucky if you run 100 metres, probably only about 70 metres.
Yeah, having the reverse availability of the turbines would have been great back in those days, and they still are today on seaplanes.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, to do it when you're in the air, just above the water, really, really pulled it up in a hurry. But then taking off, of course, with the PT6s, you could spool them up to take off at RPM with the prop in beta. And then when you were ready, you just increase the pitch of the propeller blades and it would leap forward. So we went out into the choppier water, rougher water in the open sea, heading towards the calmer water, aiming to be on the step just as we came into the calmer water. And then as you sort of pick out speed, just crank on a bit of flap, 1 degree, 1 notch of flap, and it would just leap into the air. And I know, you know, the general rule is you don't use flap in a twin-engine aeroplane on takeoff, because if one flap fails, you know, if an engine fails, you've got all sorts of asymmetric problems. But there are times when you perhaps can use it, and we did there.
And that's one of the great things about float planes and flying boats, isn't it? These scenarios you get put in, you've got to come up with really different ways to get the job done, just like you said there.
Well, the challenge of flying boats is just, or seaplanes, it's just amazing, because unlike land where you've got everything laid on for you, you've got all sorts of conditions you've got to look at. You've got to look at where's the wind coming from, are there any bullets, is there a tide run, are there any shallows? All these things come into it. Oh, okay, we're airborne now. Which way do we turn? There's a little hill in front of me. And I guess another interesting thing was when we used to go out to the reef with the Buccaneers, we had this thing where commercial fishing boats realised that all of a sudden, if they had a breakdown and needed a part, or somebody was sick on board, they didn't have to make a trip back in. They could just get an airplane out. So we used to go flying out, and we had this query from the department back then. Oh, you know, you can't go flying out over the reef. You know, you're more than so far off land, and you're not IFR. We were able to get these maps or these charts that have been prepared by the professional fishermen, which accurately showed where all the reefs were, the shapes, the depths, and everything else. It was quite amazing what those guys had done. And we showed the department these and said, this is how we navigate. It's as long as it's towards low tide, We can land in any of these lagoons. There's boats here and boats there. So eventually they said, yeah, that's okay, as long as you're going to meet a boat and you're not going any more than 50 nautical miles between boats or whatever. So we would even go down to the Swains, which was right down the bottom end of the Great Barrier Reef. But, okay, you get down there and you've got a boat and in a lagoon and it's low tide. You'd never been there before. Where do you land? Ah, that's all right. You can land there, but how are you going to go about your takeoff? How are you going to make sure when you're sitting in a lake buccaneer so low to the water, you're not going to run into a reef? The idea was that we would do a dummy run over our planned operating area, take a compass heading, and pick a starting point that we would recognise when we're on the water, knowing that we've got this straight line from there if we stay to that compass heading. So then we'd come in and land, go to the boat, do the changeover, whatever it was, go back to the starting point, turn around onto the heading, power on, away you go. You know, these things were all things that we had to develop for safe operations, and they worked very well.
Yeah, that's crazy. Now, let's go a bit more deep into the Mallard operations there. So you've been operating them around the Whitsundays for a little bit. You've had some not-so-positive times with the change in the dollar and some competition with boats. What was the next step there?
Well, the thing was that because of interest rates then just kept going up, once they got to about 18%, we were in real trouble because our debt, we were making payments, but we couldn't get the debt coming down. In fact, it was going up. And we ended up over $1.9 million in debt. And the financiers, if this government loan, were getting worried, and the government's getting worried that the loan might be called in. So the advisors for this finance company that provided the loan, who also were the ones who were reporting to the government, said, you've got to change your operation. And they said, we want you to move the operation to Cairns because there's more work up there. I said, I beg your pardon. It's not going to work in Cairns because there are different circumstances up there. You know, there might be more people and so on, but there's more boats, the reef's closer, the reef's not as good, and so on. We want you to move the operation to Cairns. I said, oh, okay. So I went back and immediately put the turbine mallard on the market. And it so happened that about 2 months earlier, a guy from Bond Petroleum, their operations manager, they were just setting up the oil well on Barrow Island off the west coast of WA. And he said, look, I was over in the Whitsundays last year and I went for a flight in your mallard. And he said, I think that'd be just the aeroplane to service this island because we can't put an airstrip on the island. Can you give us a quote on doing something over there? I said, oh, not really. Oh, okay, I'll see what we can do. So when things were getting tight, I thought, oh, well, maybe this is the way to go. So I was working on that, and all of a sudden I had a call from Bell Helicopters. Bill from Bell Helicopters called me up and said, I believe that Bond Petroleum wants you to do this contract over there with the Mallard. I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, well, we won't try and do it with helicopters, but they won't have anything to do with it. I want to use that mallard. He said, can we join you? I said, well, join Fetcher. And he said, yeah. I said, oh, we'll look at it. So I sent him all the information I'd done on the mallard and everything else. And he said, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, well, I guess we could do that. So this was sort of in the air when these guys put this pressure on me about we've got to move to Cairns. I rang Bill up, said, Bill, look, I'm not really interested in having an operation on the other side of the country and me being over here. I said, why don't I sell you the aeroplane and you do it all yourself? Oh, I don't know about that. I said, well, it's probably the best way it'll work. Anyway, he hummed and hard and hummed and hard about it. And in the end, I had an inquiry from the Virgin Islands about buying it because I'd let people overseas know. Back in those days, it was all telex. I sent Bill a telex and saying, look, I've got an inquiry about somebody else wanting this aeroplane. didn't tell him it was to go out of the country. If you want to do anything, I need to have an answer within 24 hours. Please telex me back tomorrow morning. Blow me down if he didn't telex back tomorrow morning and saying he'd take it. I went down to a finance company and the advisors and said to them, I've sold the Mallard, the turbine Mallard. Oh, you can't do that without our approval. You won't get enough money for it. I said, I got enough money for it. I said, how much you get for it? I said, 1.8 million. What? I said, and then I got 150 extra for the spare engine. What? I said, don't you bastards ever tell me how to run my business in future. How did I enjoy that? So, yes, we ended up with only 20,000 in debt at the end of all that. Wow. So that was the turbine Mallard departed, and we pressed on then with the piston for many years. But we decided that with the turbine going, we'd investigate Beaver float planes. And I went overseas to investigate them and have a break, took my wife and kids over as well, because we'd been under enormous pressure with all this debt and so on. So while I was over there, I thought, definitely Beaver's way to go. So I came back and I said to the guys, okay, we're definitely going to get a Beaver. And they said, it's all right, we've got to. I said, what? They had actually hired two Beaver float planes from Sydney that were just straight float planes. We actually operated those out of Shute Harbour for probably 2 years. And it was just a real pain. But, you know, any service, any real service, we had to chuck them back along the road with police escort and also the moorings down at Shute Harbour with all that flash, and we ended up having one sink down there. The other reason we were going to sell the Mallards, I missed this bit, and it was 86 that we actually sold the turbine. It was Bob Hawke got re-elected in 86, early 86, and I said to Sue, that's it. We're going to sell, it's after we sold the Mallard, I said, we're going to sell the business because I don't trust the bastard. And she said, what's that? And I said, well, he said he'd take the excise down 10 cents and he didn't. I just don't trust him. So we immediately set about getting ready to sell the business. I thought, well, instead of these straight float beavers, we'll get some amphib beavers. So I went overseas again and saw Bob Whitlinger, and we did a deal to buy three completely overhauled beavers on brand new amphib web air floats. So they were being delivered in early 88. And also in early 88, Lindemann Aerial Services had an Islander and an Apache were in trouble, and they decided they wanted to get out. So we ended up taking over their operation as well. So we ended up with about 12 aeroplanes all told in 88. And we ended up selling the business to the O'Hare Corporation, who had the Bill Lane's old seaplane operation down at Southport, which they called Sea Air. And they had this idea of operating seaplanes all up and down the Queensland coast. And they had this great ambition. And they actually did a full page ad in the Courier Mail of the channel between Hook and Hardy reefs saying, this is our runway. You know, it was all very impressive. But they wanted to re-image the whole thing. So they wanted to change the name to Sea Air, and they painted the aeroplanes up in Sea Air colours, even though they'd just been painted in Airwood Sunday colours. It was a lot of expense. And they said to the engineers, oh, we want the piston Mallard done up. Make it as best you can. You never say that to engineers. But anyway, they did. unfortunately, they took over on the 1st of July, 88. They bought the operating business, all the spares and the ancillary equipment. They were leasing the aeroplanes on a basis that they would had the option to buy them and they'd look after them as though they were their own. And they'd lease the airstrip with an option to buy it. Come September, only 3 months later, early September, they bought the airstrip. So we sold them the airstrip and they're still hiring the aeroplanes. But then new chief pilot, who had been the chief pilot at Southport, was actually training a guy at Bundaberg in one of the Beavers, and he actually had two other people in the back, which he shouldn't have had. And maybe he was doing a load check, I'm not sure. But they did a turn that was too tight, and the airplane stalled and dropped in, and everybody was killed, and the airplane went to the bottom. And that really knocked the business around big time to start with. But then came February 89, and what happened? Pilots dispute.
Yeah, of course.
And I said to Sue, yeah, and guess who's instrumental in making the airline business go out of business? Bob Hawke and Sir Peter Abels. I said, I knew I didn't trust the bastard. So I was vindicated then. If we'd been still in business then, we would have been out of business. But here we were. We still owned the airplanes, including one Mallard. By this stage, we only had two Buccaneers, which were US at the time. They were awaiting overhaul. What we had done, we used to buy the Buccaneers brand new when they were reasonably priced. Like the first Buccaneer we bought in 73 was $33,950 Australian dollars. That was when the Australian dollar was buying $1.50 US dollars. So it was a really great time to be buying aeroplanes overseas. When we had our own maintenance organisation, we decided, well, you know, this is a bit silly. What we'll do is we will operate the aeroplanes for 3 years, and then we'll give them a major overhaul, and then we'll operate them for another 3 years, and in that time we will have written them off. So we'll sell them as US aeroplanes, which people can take over and then rebuild them themselves, and we would sell them for, you know, $20,000 or $25,000 and just buy a new one, basically, is what it amounted to. It's the idea. So we decided in the end that's what we'd do when we had the Beavers as well, but that's getting ahead a bit. The O'Hares managed to get Hamilton Island Aviation to take over payments for the aeroplanes, and they were operating them. And a lot of stories involved in that there too. But anyway, we had arranged a security deposit from Hamilton Island Aviation so that if the airplanes came back not in the state they were supposed to be, we had money to do something with them. When the first Beaver came back, it was an absolute disgrace. And we put on our own engineer. We talked our hairs into allowing us to use the hangar for repairing it. And we ended up rebuilding that. And eventually we ended up with all the aeroplanes back. But prior to that, the O'Hares hadn't been able to do anything with the airstrip, of course. They'd allowed Hamilton Island to use it. But Hamilton Island were only running one Cessna in there once a day just to say they were using it so that they couldn't. They were virtually stopping anybody else from getting in. So I said to Sue, I want to buy the airstrip back. And she said, no way. I said, come on, just wait a minute. I want to make a cash offer, ridiculous, no conditions, because they've been advertising it internationally and everything else, and nobody was interested because nothing was happening there. But I knew what could happen there. In the end, we made a ridiculous offer on the airstrip. It was accepted. And there's a lot more to that story too, but that's in the book as well. And we ended up, within a month buying the airstrip back, we had a fully operational airport bringing in a great amount of money every month. We put in different operators for different sectors of aviation. For example, we had a seaplane operator, a helicopter operator, a skydive operation, and so on, and set up a cafeteria at the airport as well. All of a sudden, it went from being an absolute nothing to really firing. The seaplane operation, I actually took a 50% share in, and I was supposed to be a silent partner, but I ended up more than that. But we had the three Beavers, and we decided we'd follow the maintenance schedule of the that we had with the Buccaneers, and that is every 3 years we'd pull them apart, put them back together again, and then every 6 years we'd really pull them right down, completely rebuild them, do as much work as we could to modernize them and put them back in the air again. And that's what we did. And they, the engineer we had, Reg Mason, was just brilliant. And he got approval to move the bulkhead back, put more seats in, extra windows, and they made a magnificent aeroplane out of them. In the meantime, we still had the piston mallard, and the O'Hares, before the pilot strike, had organised to buy another two. There's more stories involved in that, but they ended up cancelling the order for the second one, but the first one was already on its way. So they ended up with two mallards that really weren't getting used at all. And one day, I think it was 91 or 92, I got a call from a guy at Paspaley Purling. And he was their maintenance guy and the guy who was responsible for all the equipment and the boats and that servicing the Pearl Farms. And he rang me up and he said, look, I was down there last year and I had a flight in one of your mallards. And I think that'd be just the shot for our Pearl Farms. I managed to talk Paspaley into doing a charter. And if you could bring one up here, give us a quote on bringing one up here and taking it down to Broome via Coorie Bay, also flying out to the Pearl Farms out of Darwin here, you know, send it to me and I'll put it to him. Okay. So I did that. Yep, okay, it's all approved. We organised it. And as it turned out, at that stage, the O'Hare Mallard was US. So the only one that was serviceable was mine. And Terry O'Hare said to me, don't you sell them your aeroplane. If you're going to sell one, sell them ours. I said, okay, that's fine, Terry. So we took the Mallard up and we got ready for this ferry flight. And then who gets on board on the flight on the way down but Mrs. Paspaley Sr. I thought, oh, this is amazing. You know. Anyway, it turns out she was a hostie on the Qantas flying boats before the war.
Oh, wow.
And she just, it just blew her mind away to be able to go back on a flying boat and fly down to Broome. It was just fabulous to have her on board. She was just such a lovely person. But anyway, the flight went very well. We got back and Nick called me into his office and said, tell me why we should look at your aeroplane instead of a helicopter. And I said, well, what helicopter are you looking at? And he said, there are two we're looking at. One is this one and the other one's that one. I said, well, look, I'll tell you what. I'll go back and I'll do a study on doing that run that we just did using each of those aircraft. I said, I won't charge you anything for it if you buy the aeroplane. Okay. So I went back and, of course, if you'd said to somebody, design me a flying boat to service this route, they would have designed a Mallard, wouldn't they?
No, exactly. And that's why they're still around today.
It just was so perfect for it. The helicopters, it just blew the helicopters out of the water. Not only cost operating wise, but time wise and range wise. Sent it all up to Nick and he said, yeah. So Terry and he did a deal on the price. I don't mind them buying Terry's because I know that in a short period of time, they will want ours as well. And would you believe it was probably only 18 months later, they rang up and said, you want to sell that other one? I said, yes. And how much? I said, gave them a figure and they said, okay. So they ended up with the two. And at this stage, of course, they ended up with Rod Johnson, who is my brother-in-law, as chief pilot. And, of course, Rod knew a lot about the maintenance of the Mallards as well. And they then decided they wanted to turn it into a turbine, one of them into a turbine. I'm not sure whether they bought the other turbine before that or not.
I think they did because they had the three going for a long time. They had the turbine and the two pistons, but
okay,
I think with the reliability of the turbine, they realised that turbine was definitely the way to go, so that's when they converted the other two into turbines.
They got in touch. The turbine was originally done by Frakes in Cleburne in Texas. He had the STC for supplementary type certificate, for those who don't know, for the conversion of the piston mallard into a turbine. And Paspaley's got on to Frakes and said, hey, Fred, we want to do this conversion. Can you send us out a kit to do it? He said, no. You send the aeroplane over here, I'll convert it, and then you'll have it back. And they said, no way, and we're going to send the aeroplane over there and let him get his claws into it and run up whatever Billy likes. So Rod said, you know, look, maybe we should look at doing this conversion ourselves. So he spoke with aeronautical engineer in Perth, and together they worked on the conversion, which is the one that's there now. Rod, of course, in his always wanting things to be the best, said, you know, look, got to make this a true IFR aeroplane. It's got to be dual avionics and everything else because, you know, there's important people flying in this aeroplane. So he made it absolutely bee's knees. But that's the story of the Mallards getting to Paspali.
Yeah, and then they're still there today. And people don't realise, actually, the first episode that I've done in this on this show, it talks a lot about the differences between the Frakes Mallard and the AT Mallard, or Australian Turbine Mallard, which it's now designated. It goes into a high detail on what the differences are. And people don't realise as well that even that turbine Mallard that they had got converted again to a different turbine because they did a lot of different changes from the Frakes version to create their own version that works so well in the purling operations.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Kevin, you what happened after all this? You got rid of the Mallards and then eventually sold out all your shares in Airwit Sunday. And tell us a little bit more about the later part of your career.
Well, coming into 98, probably earlier than that, I decided that, you know, really, it's been such an intense time operating seaplanes because there's so many things that can go wrong, so many things that did go wrong. It's very demanding, but very rewarding, mind you, because that's life, isn't it? The more challenge there is, the more reward, and the better the reward is. But I decided, well, time to move on, and particularly, you know, my wife took the brunt of a lot of this sort of stuff, working in the office and doing all the accounting and so on. She was operations manager for a while, and she always wanted to sort of dovetail charters together so that, you know, it's all about bums in seats, isn't it? Or, as they say in the accommodation industry, it's all about bodies in beds. But it's, you know, the more you can dovetail things together, the better it is. And unfortunately, she still wants to try and do that with me. If I'm going down to the shop, oh, why can't you wait until tomorrow when we're going there? This sort of thing. But decided I was going to sell it again, sell out again. But I thought, well, I don't want to have what happened before when we sell to somebody who doesn't really have their heart in the business. I thought I'll sell it to the staff. There's a couple of advantages in that because I'm able to, one, get a regular income coming in instead of getting a big cash injection in. It gives them a chance to buy the business. I'm only paying income tax instead of capital gains tax, which makes a big difference. And I set about it where I sold the business with a payback arrangement, where they pay back so much a month. And when the business was paid for, they'd still be leasing the airplanes from me. At the end of the period when the business was paid for, they would pay off the aeroplanes on a basis of sort of still the lease payments, but would be writing them down all the time. And that worked pretty well. It's interesting because those Beavers worked so well on that operation. And because we were back to about six seats, we had seven passenger seats actually, it worked really well for the sort of demand that was around where we could go to an island or a boat and pick up six people at a time, go to the reef, come back. And the operation had become much more streamlined because of that. And it was turning over great money. When I sold the business was actually turning over an average of $2 million a month.
Wow.
Mind you, the costs were very high, but, you know, it was quite a turnover. And then when the staff eventually sold it, it was about 4 years later, they were actually turning over $2.5 million a month. We had a great parts supply. We had an engine on spec from Superior Engines in Los Angeles, where they'd send us an engine. We didn't pay for it until we used it, but it was on the basis that if anybody else in Australia wanted it, we'd send it to them and they'd pay for it, and immediately Superior would send us another engine. So what a great arrangement, but that went by the board after the staff sold it. But anyway, yeah, just when I sold my final share, still had the airport until 2002 when I sold it. And when I finished business, I was offered by CASA an approval to train pilots to fly seaplanes while ever I held a private license. And I didn't have to have an AOC or anything else. I started doing that with people who had their own aeroplanes. But in 2003, I had been using another guy's aeroplane to train other pilots as well, but he had to sell it. He had no longer had a use for it. So I saw a Lake Buccaneer advertised in Wangaratta in Victoria. And I went down and had a look at it. The price was right. So I ended up buying that with the idea of using it for training. And I used that until November 18. So for 15 years, I had that Lake Buccaneer. It's probably one of the best I've ever owned, even though it was one of the oldest. In fact, it was a converted Lake 180. It was the prototype Buccaneer, actually. And it had a few things that were different to the production Buccaneer. But it just flew so beautifully. And the Lake Buccaneer was a most maligned aeroplane when I first got involved with it. And there were a lot of accidents where people were sinking them and they were saying, you know, I hit a log, I hit a turtle, all this sort of thing. But I know that really the problem was poor training. There's just a very simple secret to flying the Lake Buccaneer that I didn't really learn until probably 15 years ago. Using this technique just made it one of the best aeroplanes ever made. And I just cannot say enough about how I love the Lake Buccaneer. And I love the Mallard too. It's just a big Buccaneer in actual fact.
Yeah, and at last year at Rathmines, we at Paspaley got to fly down the Mallard on that safari flight to join the Catalina Festival. And there was a great photo of you with your old Buccaneer at the time because you just recently sold it. And one of the Paspaley Mallards that we'd flown down. You with your two favourite flying boats.
Yes, exactly. Two favourite aeroplanes.
So you did a fair few endorsement trainings and float or flying boat endorsements over the years. You've been residing in just outside of Sydney for the last 15 years now, have you?
Since 88, 98, I beg your pardon, we've lived at Tawantin near Noosa.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, good area down there.
And, I've done, I'm not sure, it's in the hundreds of endorsements. It's interesting because people say, oh, you must have a lot of hours. But seaplane flying is not about hours, it's about water landings. And I only have a bit under 9,000 flying hours, but I've got over 22,000 water landings.
That's a pretty good ratio.
My average flight time, because I haven't counted land landings, but my average flight time is probably only about 10 minutes. So I know a lot about landing.
Yeah. Now, that's one of the things with flights, isn't it, that you don't really rack up a lot of hours very quickly. I think throughout my career so far, I've only just ticked over around 4,500 in 12 years. So it's really only an average of about 400 a year, whereas some of these airline guys are kind of up near the 800, 900 hours a year. It's not an hour-building career, is it?
No, that's one of the things that the insurance company put me onto it when we first got the aeroplane. They said, look, I don't care how many hours you've really got. It's a number of water landings you do that really give your experience with the seaplane. So I've always logged water landings, and everybody I've trained, I've told them they've got to log their water landings for insurance purposes. So, but yeah, it makes it a much more interesting flying career, I think, to be able to have that many landings.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than be, you know, I once heard somebody say, well, what's your airline flying like? Oh, hour upon hour of sheer boredom, punctuated by moments of stark terror.
Now, I want to just touch on this book that we've mentioned a lot through the interview. You're currently writing a book. When are we going to be able to get our hands on it? Because I know I'm keen.
Well, I guess you're making me keener to get back into it. I had a real burst when I started, and I've done over 10,000 words so far. Then I reached the point where I didn't do anything for a while, and I kept thinking, now, what have I put in and what haven't I? And I've got to go back and read through it. see where I've been. So I've been ignoring it for quite some time now, but I really should get back into it. But by doing this, I'm becoming keener.
That's good. And I'm sure listeners out there, if you are listening and want to give Kevin some encouragement, send me a message. And let's make sure that we get this book out there as soon as possible, because the stories so far that we've heard, I know, are certainly wetting my lips for getting my hands on that book and spending some hours reading about all the stories that you've been through in much finer detail.
Yeah, well, I'm intending to call the book Turning Points, because there have been times, particularly in the business, and it's related mainly to the business side of it, when I've had to make major decisions that could have gone either way, and they've been real turning points.
Yeah, that's probably a fitting title then. Kevin, it's been awesome having you on the show and talking about your a bit of a brief history of flying over the last 50 probably odd years. Before we get going, I've got a little splash and dash questionnaire. So just like the land plane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash, we're just going to touch on a few seaplane related questions. I'd like to start off with, you've got a lot of experience on all types of float planes and flying boats, but what has been your favourite seaplane that you've ever flown? I think I know the answer. But
Lake Buccaneer.
I thought you might say that.
Yeah, well,
I can't wait to get my hands on one day, and it'd be great to have you in the cockpit with me.
It's more personal than the Mallard. The Mallard is great, and it's been very rewarding flying that, but I've had so much fun in a Lake Buccaneer, particularly in more recent times when I really learned how to put it on the water nicely.
Now, I'm sure you've flown in all these different areas, but you've got a lake, a river, or open ocean. Which would you prefer to land or operate a seaplane in?
A reef lagoon.
A reef lagoon. I didn't put that in there. That's one of my favourite spots. I'll make sure I add that to the question for future pilots.
Yeah, I think rivers are very interesting. Lakes can be challenging. Open sea, not very fast on.
Yeah, there's a few stories there that certainly don't make me too keen to go out and take a Lake Buccaneer into the open ocean. Out of the seaplanes you haven't flown, what would be a dream seaplane for you to get your hands on?
Well, I must admit that over the years I've thought, well, now if I was going to make a seaplane, what would I make? And I thought, well, it'd be a similar sort of configuration to the Buccaneer, but it'd be made out of composite material. It would have what they used to call sponsons in the old days, like the old Boeing flying boats and the German flying boats used to have.
Along the hull there.
Yeah, the sort of what Icon call the sea wings, which is the floats there which make it easy to get in and out of the aeroplane when you're in the water. You know, you want to go for a swim, you can stand up on it and dry yourself off before you get back into the aeroplane. And all in all, when the Icon first was proposed, I put my money down for a deposit because it was what I would have designed if I was designing an aeroplane. So if my dream machine is the A5, and I've actually flown it, and it is a dream machine, there's no doubt about it. It's not as challenging to fly as a Lake Buccaneer. That's not so good, I guess. It's easier to fly, but that probably makes it more of a trap. Basically, the concept is good.
Yeah, finally, Kevin, you've probably trained a lot of, you know, aspiring seaplane pilots throughout your career as an instructor, but also your time at Airwit Sunday. What would be your best advice for someone who's looking at getting into the float plane industry and trying to make a career out of being a float pilot?
Well, first and foremost is be very safety conscious. There are more chances of things going wrong. And when they do go wrong, they can be very expensive. They're probably not as life-threatening as normal aeroplane accidents, because the water generally is a bit more forgiving, as long as you don't turn upside down or sink or whatever. But you've certainly got to have a love of water.
That's good advice. I know a lot of people getting into the float industry get into it because of a love of water as well, don't they?
Yeah. A lot of the guys I used to train were airline pilots, and they used to say it's just great to get back into doing some real flying again. And most of them had boats as well. So, they were just marrying everything together. But it's interesting because when I first had my Lake Buccaneer, I bought in 2003, I was doing 5 or 6 endorsements every year. But it just gradually started falling away. And the last year I was doing, I only did 2. And I was charging $8,000 for an endorsement, which included 10 hours flying over 3 days, 100 water landings. It used to cost me at least $4,000 a year for an annual inspection. It used to cost me $1,000 a year for my aviation medical with AvMed and their stupid demands that they have. I was doing almost the same medicals as what airline pilots do, even though I was only flying single engine airplane with another pilot on board. And then, of course, there's the hangarage of the airplane and insurance, which was about another $4,000 or $5,000. So, just have to be sensible about these things.
Did you find that because in Australia, there's really the Mallards are the only commercial operating flying boat, and there's really not that many commercial operating flying boats as such in the world. Was doing endorsements maybe trailing off because there wasn't that much demand? It was more float plane orientated?
Oh, definitely. For commercial operations, it's more float plane. Mallards being the only flying boats that are operating. And it's interesting, I think Paspali used to always try and get the guys initially who had a Buccaneer experience, but then it was Beaver experience, because water experience is definitely critical with operating something like a Mallard because of the steep learning curve. If you've got to learn the water as well as the aeroplane, And this was the other thing that when we put on pilots back in those days when we had, say, 3 Buccaneers and 4, 5, because of the cost of training up a pilot, we would put a guy on as a groundsman to help with all the groundwork and also help with the cleaning of the aeroplane after the flying and this sort of thing, and to help with the guidance of people at the reef. In doing all of this, they were learning about the operation, they were learning about the water at the reef and all this sort of thing. So it sort of helped by the time, and then I would do their endorsement staged over probably 4 to 6 months, where we'd pick suitable days and so on. And so by the time they actually got their endorsement, they were very au fait with the operation, and the learning curve wasn't as steep. So it made it easier to do the endorsement.
Yeah, and operators still do that these days. You know, they get guys to come and show their face and wash planes for a little bit. And, you know, the training's certainly not just here's the keys, jump on in and get going. So it takes a long time to train up a float pilot to be exposed to all those elements, especially around the Whitsundays, which can be so variable in so many areas.
That's right, yeah.
Well, mate, once again, thanks very much for coming on the show. It's been great hearing your stories and probably echoing the words of most people out there. Get that book sorted, will you?
Yeah, I will do.
Get Sue to crack the whip and get writing.
Okay.
Especially with this COVID-19 stuff, mate. You've got a lot of time on your hand, don't you?
Yeah, I'm getting bored too, so maybe it's the right time. I'll probably have to start on it tomorrow.
Okay, that's a deal. Thanks again, Kevin. All the best.
Okay, then. All right. Thanks, Daniel.
Wow, what a very cool story, everyone. Thanks so much to Kevin Bowe for opening up and sharing his story with us all here on The Step. Now, it is time to leave a review if you love the show. And as always, to get in touch and contact me, find me on Instagram at thatmallardguy or email thatmallardguy@hotmail.com. Before we go, folks, Saturday's episode is one I am jumping out of my skin to get to you. Here's a taste.
Especially the turbine mallard when you're light, because those turbines have so much power and that airplane just leaps onto the step. It's just tremendous torque on the airplane. The airplane inherently wants to turn to the left. I mean, if you're heavy, the last thing you want to do is pull back the power on one of your engines as you're trying to climb on the step. So sometimes you just push them both up at the same time let the airplane go left, get on the step, then pull the right engine back, kick the nose around to the right, then bring the right throttle back up. At the same time, you're trying to keep the thing from porpoising. I mean, it's a handful. It is an absolute handful. I didn't experience that in the Twin Otter. Those two floats track straight through the water, no issues at all.
Mallard flying in the US Virgin Islands. Oh my God, what a dream that would have been. And hearing Michael Steers tell his story will get you licking your lips for sure. Until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.